From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Everyone agrees the blues is roots music. But is this the blues?
Bounce, baby. Just bounce, baby.
Matthew Johnson, head of Fat Possum Records, thinks this is the blues. He says remixes of old tunes stand squarely in the blues tradition and might save the blues.
If it's not changing or something's not evolving, it's dead. That's probably the big problem with blues. It's lost all of its edge.
Today we begin a four-part series on music. This hour, roots music, its origins, and where it's at today. We'll talk to Nora Guthrie, the daughter of Woody Guthrie. And we'll ask a loaded question. What is authentic country music?
People who like old-time music, such as I do, we tend to dismiss Top 40. You know, it's not country as I know it. It certainly doesn't sound like it came from the kind of working-class culture that originally produced this music.
You're listening to traditional fiddle music of Cape Breton Island, just off the coast of Nova Scotia. Back in the mid-70s, there was a film called The Vanishing Cape Breton Fiddler. This documentary infuriated Father John Angus Rankin. He took it as a challenge and vowed to gather 100 fiddlers together in his parish to prove the Cape Breton fiddle tradition was alive and well. 104 fiddlers showed up. One of them was a young girl named Natalie McMaster. McMaster is now considered one of the world's greatest fiddle players. She told Anne Strangechamps about a life steeped in the Cape Breton music tradition.
I started step dancing when I was 5. My mom taught me to dance. And then I was playing piano a little bit. Like I had a little organ, a little like 15-key organ. You know, I'd play little fiddle tunes out on it. And there was lots of fiddles in the house, but they were full size. I couldn't even reach. Then when I was 9, we received a fiddle from a grand uncle who was living in Boston, and he sent up this 3/4 size fiddle, and it fit me perfectly. And I said, you know, I was so excited. I was like, oh my gosh, this is my fiddle and I'm going to play it.
Were you disappointed when you first tried? Because wasn't it hard to play at first?
Wasn't disappointed at all. And I didn't find it very difficult because I think that's because I heard it so much. You know, it's like talking. Wow. If you hear people talking around you, you're a baby. Eventually, you learn to say mama.
Could you play an example of that kind of music that you grew up listening to?
Sure.
Did you also learn, sort of the history of the music? I guess I'm wondering, are there stories that go with any of the songs?
Well, there are words, there are lyrics to some of the tunes. See, at home we call the instrumental pieces tunes and the vocal music songs. And my grandmother was a great Gaelic speaker and full of music, just full of. I have yet to meet anyone on this earth that was as full of music as she was. It was unbelievable. She just got so much joy from it. She used to, if I'd swing onto a tune that she'd, you know, she'd get all excited, and if she'd start singing the lyrics, the Gaelic lyrics. There's a tune on the fiddle now. I'm just to help the listeners understand kind of what I'm talking about. I don't know Gaelic, and I don't pretend to know it at all, but I can go from memory a little bit the phonetical sound of what she would sing. But there's this tune that I play, an old tune that, you know, I didn't think too much, it wasn't anything special, but it goes, and when I'd swing into that, she'd sing this with me. She'd go, a tree, a tree, something like that, okay? God help me if there's any Gaelic speakers out there, they're going to say, what is she saying? Anyway, I totally butchered that, but my point being that she'd have these great old Gaelic lyrics, and the way she would jig the tunes, we call that jigging, she would resemble a lot of the similar sounds that I was making on the fiddle. She'd resemble with her voice and with her throat. Wow. And she had a lot of guttural, you know, sounds and throat sounds. And that particular tune was written for my great-great-great-grandfather. It was a tune composed for his three-legged rooster. That's what the tune is about.
That must be amazing.
Yeah. Like, when she told me that, I was like, oh, my gosh, that's so cool.
On your CD, In My Hands, there's a bit of your grandmother. One tune begins with an actual recording of her talking. It's really lovely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She says, I wasn't rich enough to get a violin when I was young, but if I had the money, boy, oh, boy, I would have been a violin player. And that's so true. Gosh, she would have been a hell of a good fiddler.
Reading a lot of the liner notes, there are, you know, technical names for all the tunes. You know, there are reels, jigs, strathspeys, marches. Mm. What are they all? I mean, how does a reel, is a reel definitely different than a jig, different than a march? And
right.
If you heard one, would you recognize if you knew the music?
Right. Well, I think so. It's just a matter of getting onto it. Like, I do my shows and I'm telling the crowd, okay, we're going to play this jig and then we're going to go into this reel and strathspeys and blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of the night, I figure out, okay, they haven't got a clue what I'm talking about. So I usually say, okay, by the way, these are just different labels for tunes. They're just different types of tunes. And they that title represents just the timing of the tune or the time signature. So a jig is in 6/8, for example. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then a strathspey kind of has a, it's got a lot of dotted notes in the rhythm. So it's got this kind of sound. Dee-dum, 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 da-da-da-dum, da-dum. A lot of da-dums, dotted notes. Reels are much more even. Da-da-da-da, 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 da-da-da. And it's in 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. And so on and so on. Waltz, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Exactly. Yeah.
Do you have any favorites?
I really like Blue Bonnets Over the Border, which is a tune we do in our show. It's a slow piece of music. Can also be played as a jig, which I've recorded it both ways. And there's just so many great tunes, like, you know, and it depends on my mood, too. Some days I just might be so in the mood for reels. But I'll tell you, I'm always in the mood for jigs. I love jigs. Yeah. Jigs are probably the best.
So I guess we should ask you to play a jig.
We'll do a jig that's, this is just one that my Uncle Buddy plays a lot, and it's a great dance jig. Thank you.
You've been playing, I mean, since you were a teenager, a really long time. Do you ever actually just get a little bored with Cape Breton music?
Not ever. Not ever. I totally, totally love it.
I guess I was just wondering, you know, we live in an age where most people leave where they grow up, you know, leave their roots behind. You not only have, in a big way, not left, you've carried home with you and brought it to the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And why is that home so important to you?
Well, I think that everybody does go through a stage where home just isn't that important because it means the same things. And everybody is going through that time in their life where they want to have new adventures and they want to be in a big city and they want to explore life more and all this sort of thing. And in the end, great to do that, but I find in the end all that gives you is just more of an appreciation for how good you did have it. You didn't even realize it. Like, home is just the old expression, but there is no place like home, especially talking about Cape Breton. It's a very magical spot, and anybody who has ever gone there, I think, will tell you that.
Will you play one last song?
Sure.
To end on?
Sure. I'll play you a tune that I just learned and I really, really like. It's Phil Cunningham wrote it, and he's a Scottish accordion player.
Thanks.
It's called Eternal Friendship.
That's Natalie McMaster, a traditional Cape Breton fiddler and step dancer. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Now, just ahead this hour, where does country music come from?
This music took shape in a region strongly colored by evangelical Protestant religion. And so along with the hedonism and the emphasis upon getting drunk and having a good time, there's this sense of guilt that comes out of the church, the conviction, have that good time, but you're going to be punished for it unless you change your ways.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Hank Williams once said, to sing like a hillbilly, you had to have lived like a hillbilly. You had to have smelled a lot of mule manure. Bill Malone would agree. He's America's leading historian of country music. His book, called Don't Get Above Your Raisin, traces the working-class roots of country music. Malone recently stopped by our studio to chat with Steve Paulson and play a few of his favorite songs. But they're not the kind of songs you'll hear on top 40 country stations.
People who like old-time music, such as I do, we tend to dismiss Top 40. In my opinion, you know, it's not country as I know it, and it certainly doesn't reflect those values and themes that I grew up with, and it certainly doesn't sound like it came from the kind of working-class culture that originally produced this music.
So that's, for you, the distinguishing mark of country music, of real country music, the working-class roots.
Yeah, it grew out of real people's lives, their desires, their frustrations, even their prejudices. And I just don't hear that kind of feeling today.
Now, it seems to me one of the themes that you get over and over in a lot of country songs is nostalgia, is kind of hearkening back to maybe what it was like when you were growing up, you know, what your mama was doing. And I'm wondering if a certain song comes to mind that that expresses those notions.
Yeah, one reason why I like old-time music so much is not only do I find it historically and stylistically interesting, it just puts me in touch with my childhood origins. I associate this music with growing up on a little cotton tenant farm up in northeast Texas, and with the singing of my mother. My mother confronted the world, and she dealt with it through music and through religion. Sometimes the two were entwined. I can think of a great example of this, Iris DeMint, who grew up country in Arkansas and then moved with her family to California, reflected back on her childhood, and she wrote a wonderful song called Mama's Opry, dealing with her mother's dreams and how they were expressed through music.
Well, let's listen to that song. Well, I can see why this would appeal to you, this song. I mean, just what you were saying about your own mother.
Yeah, it's hard for me to hear that song and not get a tear in my eye. And I think that's a reason why I value roots music and why I think other people should value it too, because it breathes with the feelings and the dreams of plain down-to-earth people who had almost no other avenues of expression available to them except through the church and through music.
So when you talk about the working class roots of country music, what are the themes that matter here?
Well, like all forms of music, love in all its manifestations is the most important. Everything from romantic love, you don't find many examples of that in country music, but disappointed love, abandoned love, unrequited love, cheating love. You also find a lot of themes that were there for almost from the day the music was first commercialized. You find it in the styles of Jimmie Rodgers and the Carter family, who made their first records in the first 4 days of August 1927. Jimmie Rodgers represented the rambling man, as I call him, you know, the fella who wanted to forsake responsibility, get out into the world, do his own thing, and love him and leave him, or do exciting things. And the other side of the coin, represented by the Carter family, is that of home and family. There's two sides of the same coin.
I've got a home in that rock, don't you see?
Don't you see?
I've got a home in that rock, don't you see? I've got a home in that rock, just beyond the mountaintop. Hide me, oh, rock of ages, cleft for me.
He's in the jailhouse now. He's in the jailhouse now. I told him once or twice to quit playing cards and shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now.
And that's always been the tension in so many country songs. It's kind of the lure of the road versus family,
right.
Kind of the hellraiser versus the good wife.
And more often than not, when you find songs about home, it's by somebody who's not there. Someone who's in prison or is off rambling around, off in the military, wishing to go back home, or reminiscing about a home that he'll never be able to return to.
Well, that raises an interesting question. Do you have to have working class roots to be an authentic country singer?
No, I think that you have to have an appreciation of those roots. And a great example of that would be Tim O'Brien and his sister, and just happened to have a song here that might give a good example of that. Tim has gone in many directions. He's a remarkable musician who can play just about anything. And here lately, he's been paying respect to his Celtic roots. But he's also done a lot of gospel songs, a lot of old-time country songs. And I think a good example of that would be this song called Ain't No Grave Gonna Hold His Body Down. I think he probably got it from Brother Claude Ely, a Pentecostal preacher from Kentucky. But before that, it was probably an African-American song.
There ain't no grave hold my body down. There ain't no way gonna hold my body down. When I hear that trumpet sound, gonna get up out of the ground. There ain't no way.
This song reminds us that country music didn't come from a racially or ethnically pure background.
This is not just white people's music here.
There was a culture in the South that spanned across ethnic and racial lines. This is an example of it right here. Today, a lot of people like to use terms like Celtic or Anglo-Saxon to describe this music, but I think it's real genius. Its interest lay in the fact that it was ethnically diverse. Within the South, you had these two great racial traditions interacting with each other, the African-American and the European.
But I think the traditional thinking is that country music is white people's music, blues is black people's music.
Right. When in fact, from the colonial period on, any time that white and black people came in contact with each other out in the fields or when they ventured into town for a Saturday market, they heard each other's music and they absorbed it. And white people and black people went to church together, usually sitting in segregated places. But nevertheless, they heard the same music and they heard the music out in the great outdoor revivals, the camp meetings. So there's a huge body of music there to which it's impossible to give a racial designation because it was known by people everywhere. They performed them in different styles, but even those styles intermeshed with each other.
Now, one of the places where a lot of music gets played is in bars, in taverns. And there is a tradition of honky-tonk music, which is not exactly for being up on the stage. It's somewhere kind of in between. And I'm wondering if that evokes a certain kind of experience for you.
Yeah, honky-tonk music tends to be left out in interest and preoccupation with roots music. And it's a form of roots music, too. I think there's a tendency to equate country or roots music with a pristine Appalachian past. We think of people who grew up way out in the country, who did their music in church or in a little country schoolhouse or around the family fireside, when in fact this music really took shape and was really presented to the world in these dingy bars and dance halls scattered throughout the South and all the way to California. These fighting and dancing clubs, as they were called, where a person could get killed listening to country music.
When you and your baby have a falling out, call me up, sweet mama, and we'll go stepping out, and we'll go honky-tonkin', 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 honey, baby. We'll go honky-tonkin' round this town.
And I think in many ways this music really represented the organic evolution, music born in the country, but yet made its way into the city and really took shape and became defined in these honky-tonks. And there's a young singer today out of Texas, I think he was born in the South, but he's lived in Texas for a long time, who really expresses this idea about as well as anybody. His name is Del Watson. And he has a song called Play a Real Country Song, which in a sense is nostalgic. He's thinking back on those country stations of his youth that played real country music, but he's also taking a jab at Top 40.
Mr. DJ, won't you please play a real country song? Where's your conscience? What's the problem? Speak up and say what's wrong. Play Loretta or some Conway, some Haggard and George Jones. Mr. DJ, can't you please play a real country song?
Dale Watson is a young singer with attitude. He's got slicked up hair. His arms are all covered with tattoos. It's all quite different from another Watson, the much older Doc Watson, who's usually called a bluegrass musician, though I'm not sure he'd accept that label.
Well, he's certainly been associated with bluegrass, but I think he would deny the identification, though. Actually, when Doc was discovered back in the early 60s, he was playing rock and roll music. in Western North Carolina. And that tells you something about him. He can play anything. I have a song here that I've picked out that'll demonstrate his eclecticism. He's a great fan of the blues. And in this song, we'll get an example of his guitar style and his song choices, but it'll also remind us once again of where this music comes from, that country music is not a pure white expression. It's very much indebted to African-American music and the blues. This is a song well known to blues aficionados. It's called Sitting on Top of the World.
It was in the spring, one sunny day, my sweetheart left me. Lord, she went away, and now she's gone, and I don't worry. Lord, I'm sitting on top of the world.
This was a song that had first been done by the Mississippi Sheiks back in the mid-1930s. And there's all kinds of country groups since that time have done it. Bob Wills has a version, and Milton Brown, the musical Brownies, and so on. Here's a good example of Doc Watson. If you want to hear a real old-time 16th century ballad, he can sit there on stage and do it.
Hmm.
But if left to his own devices, he'll generally pick the blues.
Now, there's an archetype of the country music singer. I mean, we're particularly talking about men here that really goes back to Hank Williams. I mean, the hard-drinking, hell-raising womanizer who's going to destroy himself. And sometimes they literally do destroy themselves, and sometimes they manage to get through it. And
it really goes back to Jimmy Rogers, and even before that, to people like Prince Albert Hunt and Charlie Poole in the 1920s. People that burn the candle at both ends.
Right. And you see it over and over. I mean, it's almost as if you're going to be considered the real article, you got to live this hard life. And I guess, do you still have to do that if you're going to be considered an authentic country singer?
Not any longer. And I guess on one hand, I guess we can welcome the waning of that tradition. But on the other hand, it's kind of sad to think of all the good music that's going to be lost as those characters disappear.
Why? I mean, so you needed to live that kind of life to get that music?
Yeah, I think because it made your music real. It made people think that you understood their problems, that you'd live the life that they had lived or wanted to live. You don't find much of that meat and potatoes music at all anymore in mainstream or top 40 country. You don't find the old-fashioned gospel songs that talk about the blood of Jesus, you know, and all the old blood and thunder, hellfire and damnation themes. You hear fewer and fewer cheating songs and drinking songs and prison songs. I'm not condoning any of those things. I'm not saying that people ought to go out and be hellfire and brimstone Christian, or that they ought to go out and get drunk or cheat on their wives. I'm just merely saying it was an awfully good song. I came out of those experiences.
Cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry and try to sleep, but sleep won't come the whole night through. Your cheating heart will tell on you. When tears come down like falling rain, you'll toss around and call my name. You'll walk the floor the way I do. Your cheating heart will tell on you.
Bill Malone writes about the working-class roots of country music in his book, Don't Get Above Your Raisin. He talked with Steve Paulson. If you're making a list of roots musicians, one man who makes the A-list for sure is folk musician Woody Guthrie.
I've been a-laying in a hard rock jail, I thought you knowed. I've been a-laying out 90 days away down the road. Damn old judge, he said to me, it's 90 days from vacancy. I've been a-hitting some hard traveling, Lord.
Up next, we'll talk to Woody's daughter, Nora Guthrie, about her father's life, his legacy, and, of course, his music. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Woody Guthrie's the quintessential folk singer, the poet of hard times, the rambling man who loved the open road. Steve Paulson got together with Woody's biographer, Elizabeth Partridge, and his daughter, Nora. Nora Guthrie says her father didn't exactly invent the political folk song, but he created a new kind of music.
There's always been a tradition of the troubadour, who was the guy who traveled around the countryside bringing the news to people who couldn't read or write. But the idea of a roving reporter-type journalist, when he sang the song of Pretty Boy Floyd, it's half journalistic, and then there's commentary. So you have the story of Pretty Boy Floyd, and then the final line of Pretty Boy Floyd is, it's through this world I rambled, I'd see lots of funny men, some rob you with a six-gun, and some with a fountain pen.
Some with a fountain pen. But it's through your life you travel, and it's through your life you roam. You won't never see an outlaw drive a family from their home.
Elizabeth, as you were digging into the songs, were there any particular surprises?
I think, first of all, just the vast number of songs he wrote, and then the way he could take a very complex situation and boil it down into a few stanzas. And he did, for example, he saw the movie The Grapes of Wrath and was asked to write a song for The Grapes of Wrath. Pete Seeger told me this story, actually. Woody ran into Pete, and he said, "Hey, Pete, you got a typewriter?" And Pete said, "I've got a friend with one. Let's go over to his place." They went over there, and Pete watched as Woody would play a few measures on his guitar, sit down, work at the typewriter for a minute, stand back up, play a few more things on his guitar, sit down. And about 10 o'clock, Pete fell asleep, and when he woke up in the morning, Woody had fallen asleep underneath the table, and there was a 17-verse song.
Tom Joad got out of the old McAllister pen. There he got his parole. After 4 long years on a man-killing charge, Tom Joad come a-walking down the road, poor boy. Tom Joad come a-walking down the road.
Did Woody Guthrie have a philosophy about what makes a good song?
Simple. He liked to keep it really simple. He thought that people got too complicated when they did their folk songs. In fact, when he wrote This Land Is Your Land, the first time Pete Seeger heard it, he thought, that's too simple. Later, Pete said, that shows you how wrong you can be. So Woody stuck with a very simple lyric. And
I think one of his quotes was, if you play more than 3 chords, you're showing off. But the idea was, you have to understand that the reason he wrote songs, I mean, so much of it had to do with participation. It had to do with rallying, activating people into some kind of movement. I don't always mean political movement. Sometimes I just mean get them moving and get your butt up, you know, off the chair.
Didn't he also think that there should be something uplifting about a song?
You know, he said, I hate a song that makes you feel low down, that makes you feel you're no good. I'm out to sing the songs that'll make you feel like this is your world, no matter how hard it's rolled you over. He was a very positive guy and also a guy who suffered from a lot of demons, but he wanted to put out a lot of really good energy.
Well, it seems to me there's a paradox at the center of Woody Guthrie's life. He, as you say, he was an optimist. He wanted to see the best in people, but his own life, especially his childhood, was quite difficult. He grew up poor. His older sister died in a fire. His mother ended up in an insane asylum. His father was often not there. It's a pretty grim story.
Yep.
It's always the people that have the toughest time that have to reach down inside themselves and struggle to find the glory of life and to find what keeps you going when times are so hard, you know. The people that have it easy don't really think about life too much.
The hard and it's hard, ain't it hard to love one that never did love you? Hard and it's hard, ain't it hard, great God, to love one that never will be true?
Woody is just a pure artist in this sense, that he reached inside of himself to keep himself walking, to keep himself going, to keep himself breathing. He had to find his own inner light, you know, his own deepest inner joy when there was no joy around him. And not only that, but he had to use that joy to try to cheer up a whole bunch of other people who were standing around hungry and starving and homeless. And that's the uniqueness of his character, his soul. Not a lot of people could do that. I mean, he had every excuse in the world to just become an alcoholic and forget about it, you know? Just end up on the Bowery, call it a day. And, you know, some people do, but for some strange reason, he was able to tap into this incredible hope.
Elizabeth, as I was reading your biography, I had the sense, the very strong sense, that Woody was restless, that he just couldn't stay still for very long, and he had to get out on the road. And in fact, didn't he say that he often wrote his best songs when he was walking down a road?
He was definitely a rambler. I mean, when things were really bad, Woody would hit the road. When things got too good, Woody would hit the road. I mean, he quite honestly made a number of really stupid decisions in his life, and it was one of the things that was very hard for me as his biographer. I kind of had the overview of his life, and I'd be sitting in my little room, and then I'd read some more stuff, and I'd be like, oh, no. I'd come bolting out of my writing room, and I'd say to my husband, you wouldn't believe what he just did.
Give me one or two examples of stupid things he did.
Okay, sometimes he did stupid, painful things, like he had a beloved daughter named Kathy Ann, and when she was 4, she was burnt to death in a fire, and it was almost unbearable for Woody and Marjorie. This was Nora's oldest sister, and Marjorie was pregnant at the time with her next child, who would be Arlo. Woody was so distraught, he took off. He hit the road. He left New York and went all the way to the West Coast and wrote these miserable letters back to Marjorie about how unhappy he was on the road. But it was the only way he could find solace was to be moving. So I just thought that was a pretty bad decision, given that his wife was at home without Kathy Ann and without him.
So long, it's been good to know you. So long, been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. This dusty old dust is a-blowing me home. I've got to be rolling along.
He basically just didn't want to be pinned down. He wanted to have the freedom to turn around, which is why he never really joined, like, the Communist Party. There's a lot of discussion about, was he a communist? He couldn't have joined any party. He couldn't belong to any organization. He couldn't be married to one woman in the traditional sense. He was not a father in any kind of normal sense of the word. He had to do just the opposite of what was expected. That was part of his mischievousness and part of his humor and charm, too. And really irritating to a lot of people, I might add.
Well, I can imagine, especially for family members. Now, when you say he wasn't a father in the normal sense, did you ever really know him? I know you were pretty young when he died, but how close did you get to him?
I was 17 when he died.
Oh, okay. But he was in ill
health.
He was
in the hospital.
For many of those
years. Yeah, he was in the hospital since I was about 1.5 or 2, actually 4. But he used to come home on the weekends. We'd bring him home and have hootenannies and musicians and a lot of people around. But I remember one of my mom's typical stories about him. She said he would go out in the morning to buy a pack of cigarettes and come home 2 weeks later. And I mean, now we're sitting here laughing.
I know, but it wouldn't have been funny at the time.
But as we describe it, you're really describing the flow of an artist in a way. My mother could be at peace with that. Now, Woody's first wife, Mary, wasn't at peace with that, and it's not the kind of thing that rubs everyone the right way. My mother happened to be a dancer who worked with Martha Graham, and she had a lot of contact with very eccentric artists. I mean, she understood, and she would explain to us, his work is out there in the streets, and that's where he goes. And he would go to pick up a pack of cigarettes, and he'd run into someone in the store, and they'd say, hey, Woody, there's a rally on 14th Street. Come on down. He'd say, okay. And then from there, he'd meet someone. Oh, there's a thing happening in Philadelphia. You want to come? Hitch a ride? Sure, yeah. So he followed his muse, and his muse was the road and people. He loved the talking to people and hearing people's stories. And that's, I think, it's like you have a love-hate thing. Is that a good quality or a bad quality? Could he have written This Land Is Your Land without it? I don't think so.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Nora Guthrie runs the Woody Guthrie Archives. Elizabeth Partridge's biography of Woody Guthrie is called This Land Was Made for You and Me. They talked with Steve Paulson. Guthrie wrote some 3,000 songs, though the vast majority have never been recorded. They're stashed away in the Guthrie Archives. Recently, Nora Guthrie let Billy Bragg and Wilco peruse the stacks of Woody's unrecorded music. One of the songs they picked out is California Stars.
I like to rest my heavy head tonight on the bed. The California stars, I like to lay my weary bones tonight on the bed. The California stars, I love to feel your hand touching mine. Tell me why I must keep working on. Yes, I'll give my life to lay my head
to Mississippi Delta blues musician Johnny Farmer. A bulldozer driver by trade, Farmer was discovered and recorded by Matthew Johnson. In the early 90s, Johnson started Fat Possum Records so he could record the raw Delta and Hill Country blues he heard in the juke joints around his home in Oxford, Mississippi. He felt if he didn't record this music now, he would be lost forever. But one word of warning, don't call Matthew Johnson a folklorist.
I once had a family member accuse me of being a folklorist. I'm not at all. I was like, no. To me, the agenda a lot of times is just to record something, not make a great record. It's hard enough trying to make something good with the focus on that. When you're just trying to record it or preserve it, it sort of lowers the goal.
And one of the things you've done and Fat Possum Records has done that's clearly different, I guess, from a preservationist is you've done some remixes of traditional music, putting a hip-hop DJ together with an original performer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us about how you came to do that and how it works?
You know, a lot of people do think that it's sort of sacred and that we are being very irreverent. There's no other genre that's sort of valid where you would be taken to task for taking advantage of, like, technology that's 15 or 20 years old already. You know, I mean, it's sort of insane. I mean, it's like, you know, I feel that, like, I'm trying to sort of sell something like Jimi Hendrix music to a world that's never heard Jimi Hendrix, but only all of the bad imitators.
Well, let's hear some of this. This is T-Model Ford's Look What All You Got.
Okay.
Something on my shoulder, waiting for your babe. I got something on my shoulder, you're just waiting for your babe. I got something on my shoulder, you're just waiting for your babe.
That's pretty nice. And but then what you did with it, or one of the things you did anyway, is to create a hip-hop version of that.
I got something on my shoulder. Waiting for your baby.
Baby.
I got something on my shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
You're just waiting for your baby.
Now, that's quite a change. I mean, it's like a time warp here.
Mm-hmm. I always thought there was a natural connection between hip-hop and blues. Everything from the marketing to the imaging to the lyrics to everything, I thought it was a perfect fit. You know, I mean, I was looking at an old, old Charlie Patton record that they had advertised Charlie Patton as the devil's stepchild. All of that stuff, all the sort of imaging from the 20s that they used for these blues guys to sort of create a sort of aura or danger or whatever about them, obviously exactly like hip-hop. And then, like, I guess the late 90s, maybe 2001, whatever, you know, there was a lot of sampling coming out of gospel and everything else from the big hip-hop records. And I thought it was going to work its way down to blues, or, you know, because it would sort of exhaust different genres of music, or sort of always searching for something new. Remember at one point, even I think there was a Nas record and a couple of other records that would have, like, Spanish classical guitar, like, elements in there, you know? I was thinking, Jesus, blues has got to be next. It kind of never really worked. I mean, it never really was.
And how did the hip-hop artists doing these remixes, how did they respond to the music?
A lot of hip-hop guys, they just did not like it. To them, the blues sort of was representative of a time that they would rather forget, or some of them saw it as like almost a badge of disrespect, like pushing a broom or something. And I never understood that. I mean, I thought it was a lot more edgy, a lot, you know what I mean? The blues had by then become something that long-haired white kids play, literally, you know? It sort of had been taken out of their world. I mean, it was almost like the sort of Dan Aykroyd or House of Blues thing, or that was their image of it. I mean, not the really good records could they remember. Or did a lot of these guys, were they even familiar with? You know, you do go into like the section of a blues store, or if they even got a blues record section, and there are usually some really horrible records in there. And it's tough to sort of find the good stuff. You know, a lot of these guys totally hated it. You know, when someone says, will you allow these DJs to remix it? It wasn't allowing. It was usually just bribing them. and, you know, usually you could, like, get someone to remix something and say, well, look, you can use these samples or whatever. There was, like, no interest from a lot of guys at all.
Bye.
it ever bother you? I mean, you got into this because you really liked the blues and you'd heard this music and it wasn't recorded. But what's selling is not the blues as it was, but these remixes. These are the mm-hmm. things that are your top-selling CDs, right?
You know, it doesn't bother me at all. I mean, if it's not changing or something's not evolving, it's dead. That's probably the big problem with blues. I mean, it's totally stopped. I mean, the songs now you hear are like on a local Bill Street or tourist thing. It's sort of like songs about songs. It's lost all of its edge. You know, you used to see these things on the film where you would have John Lee Hooker or somebody opening up for Jefferson Airplane or whoever. And now you don't anymore. You see blues sort of relegated to some sort of club that's all it does on Thursday night, and it's got the same sort of audience, so people are more not even really going for the music. It's just a scene or something.
It's bad, you know.
That's Matthew Johnson, head of Fat Possum Records. We're listening to R.L. Burnside from the TV hit The Sopranos. It's the remix version of R.L.'s song, It's Bad, You Know, the top-selling song on Fat Possum Records.
She asked me why. I just went on tour.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Roots Music Today, program number 1124A. If you'd like to comment on what you've heard, you can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us an email through our website at www.ttbook.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
The Cultural Revolution changed everything for Hao Zhengjian. When he was 10 years old, Jian studied piano, reluctantly. So when his piano teacher was hauled off to jail, it was a day of celebration. No more piano lessons, no more practicing. Years later, music caught up with Hao Zhengjian. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, one man's journey from Mao to Mozart. From PRI, Public Radio International.